Christmas edition of Cult Picks Radio, WCPX 66.6, coming down your chimney. With me, your host, Django Nudo.
And me, the smart peddler. I was just got my booster shot.
Oh, so microchips coursing through your veins.
Yes, I get Radio Moscow loud and clear in my head now.
You know, it's only so that Santa can find you in case you're not home. That's all they put the microchips in there for. It's really nothing sinister.
And if you've been naughty, what does the chip do?
I just assume you're naughty, so, you know, true. You're tagged for life now.
Yeah.
Anyway, we have another 8 films from the Cultmas Badvent calendar for your delight and delection. But before we get to this assorted box of Christmas candies, a few happy things to report about coming up or taking place. So why don't you tell us, because we haven't heard nearly enough about the Sweden Pornu Nikatsu screenings.
Yes, we are very excited to do a screening on Monday the 20th at Bio Aspen, Aspudden, Stockholm, Sweden, of two of the newly restored films from Nikatsu that were produced in Sweden from 71 to 73. And we owe a lot to Johan Nordström, the Swedish film historian living in Japan, who hooked us up with Nikatsu. Super exciting. You will see a lot of Swedish, quite famous actors being degraded, doing dirty deeds, Japanese style. With the Swedish dialogue.
Yeah. It's like...
And, we're actually rewriting Swedish film history.
Yeah. It's like a herring sushi or elk tonkatsu. It's a strange dish, but
very, very, very. I would say it's a Swedish Japanese smorgasbord of kinky delights.
Yes, and Johan has a great introduction video as well, which I've had a preview of, where he talks about.
So that will be introducing the screenings on the big screen.
Yeah, and maybe we should put on YouTube afterwards.
Yeah, because sure.
And I was especially impressed by his office and the magazine collection behind him, or whatever it is in the kind of bookshelf. But yeah, a lot of research gone into that.
Yeah.
So, 20th of December in Stockholm, and hopefully we'll get an opportunity to show them elsewhere. We're in discussion with film festivals and with other kind of international events. So who knows, some Sweden Pornu could be coming your way.
Yeah, because this is quite a unique opportunity to watch films that no one has watched for 50 years.
Yeah. Now, speaking of 50 years and anniversaries, there is another very big anniversary happening today, I believe. Isn't it 70 years since the premiere of Hon dansade en sommar?
That's right. One Summer of Happiness opened on this day, the 17th of December in 1951. And that film really rewrote film history, because that was like the first obvious example of Swedish sin, and then how Sweden and Swedish, especially Swedish women, have been perceived internationally with the nude swims and things like that.
And all it took was a pair of bouncing buttocks in the distance and a pair of boobs in frame for about 10 seconds, if that.
Yeah, it's like it's the smallest thing in the whole film, but that's what it's remembered for. And you know, we have it on Cult Picks, of course. We have released it on DVD from Club Super 8, and a lot of the posters from different countries are featured in the book Do You Believe in Swedish Sin, which is also comes from our office.
Yes, definitely. And we should mention, not just a film famous in Sweden, but of course it won the second ever Berlinale, Berlin Film Festival, back at the time when the films, I think, were voted for by the audience rather than a jury of, you know, guardians of culture. So, and it played in Cannes, and it's sort of the film that we need to remind people Bergman ripped off, and it was only really, though he had talent, you know, it was only after his knockoff version gain international fame, that his career took off internationally.
Yeah, Summer with Monica, 1953.
Mm. So nothing like cashing in on a trend, even if you're, you know, artsy auteur.
Yeah.
But the original celebrates 70 years today. Un danza den sommar, one summer of happiness. So do catch it on Cultpix. We'll put in a link.
Yeah.
But now on to our Christmas or Cultmas Badvent calendar, where each day we've been posting a new film from a, again, smorgasbord advent calendar of delights, and very, very different. I mean, we've been striving to have the widest possible mix of genres and films, and some real treats. It's not just like we're dumping the films that we couldn't find a theme for at the end of the year, but some that are particularly good.
And it's a wild mix that's also very much appreciated. We know a few fans that are actually watching one new film every day from this.
Exactly. So we love you. And thank you for the wonderful feedback on social media and emails and so on. So we will kick off with a tasty treat for a number of reasons, which is the number 9, Criminally Insane. 1970, maybe a criminally underrated film, because to me, this is what would happen if John Waters ever made a slasher film. It is a story, and it's a very short film, so you whisk through it in just over an hour, but it inspired definitely a cult following. So it's a film shot entirely in San Francisco about the huge, it's got a huge star in the leading role, and by that I mean she is rather morbidly obese, Ethel Yanofsky, who's been locked up for many, many years in an insane asylum due to her, you know, fits of depression and violence. And finally she's released to be looked after her grandmother, even though doctors are slightly concerned she may not be cured. And things go bad when Ethel moves in with her grandmother and is denied access to food. And, you know, I pity the soul who tries to get between her and her smorgasbord or her cake or anything. Mm. They meet a sticky end.
And she has, I believe, a meat cleaver.
She has a meat cleaver. She's got various implements for, you know, disposing of these unkind people who would rather, you know, see her go paleo or Atkins or whatever diet could be prescribed for her. It really did inspire a cult following, and some great reviews of it can be found online. I think it was DVD Talk gave it 4.5 out of possible 5-star and said, "This unfettered freak show of a fright flick starring the world's portliest serial killer, yes, even bigger than John Wayne Gacy and Leatherface combined, is so downright depraved, so tantalizing in its turgid storytelling and squalid scenarios that words cannot begin to describe its baneful beauty." Wow. And, you know, so there you go. That's the selling tagline right there. John Wayne Gacy and Leatherface, you know, combined.
And it was such a learned text that I had to look up some of the words in my dictionary.
Ah, there you go. We're educational, if nothing else. So, not just a fun film, but it inspired both a sequel, came many years later, 1987, called Criminally Insane 2, and a remake called Crazy Fat Ethel, which to me sounds a bit harsh. But anyway, there you have it, released in 2016. And who knows?
It should have been called Big Boned Ethel, I think.
I think that's more politically correct term for it today. So, without wasting any more time, shall we give people a taste of Ethel by playing the trailer?
Yeah.
Okay, here it is. Criminally Insane, 1970.
In a few moments, two people will die.
I'm going to have to kill you both.
No, Ethel!
Suspense that will shatter your nerves as Fat Ethel, with a maniac's cunning, terrorizes her numerous victim.
Do you think I'm going to let you starve me?
Another kind of monster is loose, and death follows each time that Ethel reaches for the meat cleaver.
So from the Hungary on the streets of San Francisco, we fly down under to Australia to tackle the love epidemic, made in 1975. And I have to say, one of the funniest sex education films that we have on Cold Picks, or probably that I've seen. You know, there may be inadvertent laughs in the language of love, a few jokes, but nothing like this one.
Yeah, because they're like reenacting things in it, I understand.
Yes, they have battle sequences, medieval battle sequences, to make the point that, you know, knights might have been killing each other, but venereal disease, you know, was the greatest killer of them all. And it feels appropriate as we look out the window at Omicron, you know, felling people everywhere, to be looking at a time, more innocent time perhaps, when, you know, you could be felled by sexually encounters of this kind of kind. But it really is funny in terms of getting the message across by using humor and a lot of nudity, quite a lot of nudity. So much so, and this is the funny thing about the love epidemic, is that when the film came out or was about to come out, two of the cast members, one male, one female, went to a judge and tried to get an injunction to prevent the film being shown on the grounds that it was a pornographic film. And they had only agreed to make it an educational one. So I don't know if they fired their agent or, you know, what script they read, or if they didn't notice maybe that there were naked people doing naked things as they were shooting it, including them.
It sounds like an after construction.
You know, hey, we know that there are exploitation directors who say, no, of course it's educational. Yeah. It's educational, this nudity, you know, it's not.
And also directors who added scenes after the fact.
Yes, the famous hardcore inserts of inserts.
Exactly.
So, ultimately they were unsuccessful. There have been various edits, though, of the film. I think they've done a safe for television kind of version, which maybe only had the talking professors and less of the kind of nude Asians and other people romping. But as a description online, it says it is really a drama documentary marketed at the, quote, the Raincoat Brigade. Do we know them? Are we them?
We might be, but we skipped the raincoats. We have
tougher jackets.
Not ashamed of it anymore.
No, exactly. But it does pass on information about venereal disease, and it's got serious professors, as happens at this time, making the points across, and also dressing up as historical characters like Henry VIII, you know, cursing syphilis.
That's so funny. That's amazing. There's a little digest version of the trailer.
Okay, let's hear it. The love epidemic.
Kings contracted it.
Summon the queen!
A pox on you, apothecary!
I fear the pox be upon you, sire.
Today the world suffers from it more than ever before. Yet, polite society will not discuss the love epidemic. Venereal disease is the world's oldest horror story.
You're just going about your business and then suddenly your tool drops off.
Now for the first time on film, a detailed examination of the history, the causes, the effects, the varieties, and the cures.
Modern treatment is very simple and hardly painful at all.
The love epidemic reveals what goes on inside the VD clinic. No one is immune from the love epidemic.
You know, you always warn me about toilet seats and how you should always put paper around the seat first. Of course, it's not only toilet seats. I mean, you can get it from the bite of a camel as well.
Okay, whack it in.
What?
Well, I don't mean your foot.
Somehow it sounds even better with the Australian accent, I think.
Yeah.
So, from Australia to outer space, in this case, number 11 on the Cult Picks Badvent calendar, Fire Maidens of Outer Space from 1953, Or to give it the full title, at least from the trailer, and the electronic monster of a lost planet.
Oh, Lord. I love these titles from the 50s. It's so amazing.
Do you think electronic monsters was a big selling point? Because up to then, you only maybe had, I don't know, you know, monsters made from balsa wood?
Yeah, exactly. The analog monsters as opposed to the electronic ones.
Yeah.
I guess.
They weren't ready for digital yet.
No.
So this is a film notorious for a number of reasons. It's been called a British Plan 9 from outer space, which gives an idea of kind of how high in esteem it's being held in. But it ties in with last week's Cult Pigs Radio because I feel this is an incredibly blatant ripoff of Catwoman of the Moon.
Yeah, which sounds like it.
I mean, if you look at the plot, so five astronauts travel to a moon, not our moon in this case, but the 13th moon of Jupiter. And there they discover an ancient civilization tied to Earth, consisting almost exclusively of nubile young females. And, of course, there are romantic interludes between the astronauts, and things go wrong as they happen. But, seems to be a pretty shameless knockoff, and it is funny in that kind of way that maybe it wasn't intentional, such as the 13th moon of Jupiter looking very much like the kind of countryside you'd find outside of Oxford, you know, with, you know, trees and bushes, and there's nothing remotely alien about it. Not like when they do early Star Trek or cheapo sci-fi films in the 50s in the US, where they just go out to the desert of California or Nevada, and at least it's kind of a moonish landscape without...
It looks a bit alien, at least.
Yeah, there are no recognizable earthly trees. The 13th moon of Jupiter has very Earth-like looking trees and landscapes and everything. So
they didn't even bother to make it look alien.
No. They had a soundstage
fantastic.
You know, for the temple of the moon, but apart from that, it is probably... Yeah, indeed, one of the worst movies ever made, as according to critics. They couldn't afford Elmer Bernstein music for the music either. So instead, they knocked off a lot of classical music by Alexander Borodin and the Sword Dance, for example. So even there, they went cheapskate. Really doesn't have much violence, much gore, no special effect. It's kind of just, you know, fantasy on a low budget. Where they compensate for the lack of the one alien with, you know, young women dressed in diaphanous outfits, sort of running around dancing and pretending to be the daughters of Neptune.
Yeah, it's amazing how the sort of the Greek and Roman mythology seem to mesh and go into these sort of sci-fi movies in terms of the fashion.
Yeah.
Well, it's quite odd. But then I was thinking also, since there was a comparison with Plan 9, I just watched the trailer, and to me, it sounds very, very much like Criswell is the narrator of the U.S. trailer. I would have guessed that it's like that. I Googled it, but I couldn't find any facts about it. But that voice is unmistakable.
That would make sense. I mean,
yeah,
I'm sure that he was the go-to kind of actor for those kind of trailer works.
Yeah, so, probably. It sounds very like him, at least.
Yeah. Couple of other funny things about it. The Fire Maidens are led by the wonderful Susan Shaw, very gorgeous, and sadly are somebody who's we didn't see enough of because her career did decline following alcoholism. And if the rocket is looking familiar, it is because it was an actual Nazi V2 rocket that was confiscated by the Americans from the Germans at the end of the World War II. And shots of this rocket have been cropping up in a number of science fiction films in the 1950s. So couldn't tell you which ones, but yeah, keep an eye out for it.
I love that whole idea of reusing both rockets and music. It's really something from the era.
Mm. Yeah, it's what clever exploitation film producers knew to do in order to save money. And final thing, I don't know, did you see the opening credits? Because they have
No, I missed that.
Okay. Yeah. They've got a wonderful disclaimer, which says, all characters in space are fictitious.
Thank God.
Yeah. Don't tell that to Neil Armstrong.
No, exactly.
This feeds that whole moon landing was fake conspiracy, you know.
The conspiracy, exactly.
No one's in space. It's all fiction.
No.
Well, the trailer speaks for itself. In case you aren't inclined to watch the British equivalent of Plan 9 from Outer Space, or if you haven't watched it, do watch Catwoman of the Moon, a better film. Not great, but definitely better. So to give you a taste of what you might be missing with Fire Maidens of Outer Space, here is a part of the trailer.
Here on the 13th moon of the planet Saturn are atomic forces that control the tides of all earthly desire. Within the moon's temple of love dwell the Fire Maidens of Outer Space, dedicated to the purpose of creating a new race of supermen and holding captive all who fall under their spell.
By the Lord of Atlantis, I am yours.
But theirs is a moon-mad evil love that makes victims of their own kind and puts them to the fearful ordeal by fire.
After science fiction comes fantasy in the form of the 12th Cultman's Badman calendar films, The Sword and the Dragon, 1963.
Or Ilya Muromets.
Yes. This is a film that you found, Smart Peddler. So tell us a little bit about that. I was not even aware of it.
No, I was so excited to read about it. I think it was like on a thread on Facebook. Because this is, in fact, Ilya Muromets, which is a famous Russian film by the director Alexander Ptushko. Mm. And just like other Russian films, but sci-fi films, this was imported to the US and re-edited by that, you know, the king of exploitation, Roger Corman. So it's a completely different film with different names of the characters, and everyone is dubbed. And I guess that Corman just loved the fantasy elements here, like the wind demon and the three-headed dragon. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there are so many fun things happening in this film. Which is
the land ships and the mountain of men. That one I found particularly
amazing.
Unsettling.
Especially with a horse on top of it.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
That's
you could argue that this is a different film actually than the Russian original.
It is, which is,
and of course there are some years between them, between the Russian, the Soviet premiere and the US release of it.
I also like the fact that the feature narration is by Mike Wallace. For anybody who doesn't know, famous American television news reporter, news anchor. So it's been uncanny to be hearing him reporting about dragons and giants, which is definitely fake news. They don't really exist.
It's amazing. But also I think that it was very much coveted by Corman, that it's so big. I mean, it was took years to make it. It had contained hundreds of thousands of people and thousands of horses. I mean, it's a big, big, big movie.
Yes. 106,000 in the cost, apparently. Yeah. And 11,000 horses, I'm reading from my notes here. So I don't know. That probably even makes it bigger than Pulgasari. And let's face it, the North Koreans could marshal big crowd extra scenes.
And I'm just wondering if the director was as thorough as D.W. Griffith, who had all the extras wear the exact right kind of underwear underneath their uniforms for the Civil War.
Oh, wasn't that Bondarchuk? And somebody who, you know,
was
broke the budget. Yeah, Napoleonic epic. Yeah, they must have.
Yeah, that's so crazy.
Yeah, but I went to a preview with costume designer Sandy Powell recently for a film called Mothering Sunday. Not very good, I'm afraid. Or I didn't like it anyway. And she said, yes, they must have the appropriate underwear underneath it, because otherwise the clothes hang or sit wrong. So if they have big blooming knickers, then You know, that affects, you can't have a G-string underneath
that. I thought it was a psychological thing. It's like, what's my motivation?
Yes.
Just feel your underwear.
Yes. I, you know, prefer to think of all the cost in Downton Abbey and more G-strings and kind of not caring about the fact that you couldn't have pantyhose back then. So anyway, getting slightly sidetracked here. Now, yeah,
but of course, it's fun. But also, it's been made fun of in Mr. Science Theater 3000.
That's right.
Which is...
your favorite show.
A U.S. show that I really, really dislike.
Yeah.
And based on the same fact that why I dislike these reaction videos on YouTube when someone is watching a rock video and then commenting like, oh, look, it's so funny. The guy has a strange hairdo.
Yeah.
And I mean, we all can see that hairdo, can't we? And I would say it's the same thing with making fun of 50s sci-fi movies. They were made in a different era. Obviously, the monster is going to look kind of funny for us. But everyone can make up their mind about that. You don't have to put lines in their mouths or do funny, you know, kind of funny one-liners about it. I really don't get it.
No. I, to me, and I watched it when I was in this, living in the US in the mid-1990s, and it was the introduction to a lot of films which I wasn't aware of. So in that regard, yes, it helped me explore. But today, not sure I'd want to sit through it, not sure I'd want to enjoy it as much. Having said that, I did go to a cinema in, funnily enough, in Australia a few years back, where they had a live comedians commenting a film live. They didn't pick an easy target like, you know, an old 50s cheaply made sci-fi film. They actually went for Jan de Bont's Twister, which, you know, is only 20 years old. But I think there's more of a challenge in taking a serious Hollywood blockbuster, even if it's, you know, 20 years old. And finding,
I mean, a cheesy low-budget film is so easy to make fun of.
Yeah, it's easy pot shots. So, you know, up your game, guys. And so this one I enjoyed. That works
for me. And also in terms of this particular film, and this also shows the sort of ignorance that some people, so-called film fans, are, is that they mistook the film for a Finnish film.
Yes.
But it's a Russian film. And then they make fun of Finland during the whole Mystery Science Theater 3000, which is just wrong.
Yep.
And I mean, we all know about the jokes about Sweden and Switzerland and American geography lessons. But I mean, this is ridiculous.
Yeah. No, I'm with you.
So shall we listen a little bit to the trailer? Because I love this. This is one of those pompous voiceovers that I so much enjoy.
Let's hear it.
Sword and the Dragon. 4 years in the making, with 106,000 actors, the largest cast ever used in a motion picture. All to be seen in the film process, newer than tomorrow, Vitamotion.
We move at last. The Dragon,
with the seven wonders of the motion picture world, the ferocious wind demon, the 1,000-pound colossus, the mountain of living men.
There you go, the Sword and the Dragon.
Yeah.
For your enjoyment, while you wait for the Amazon Prime version of Tolkien's Lord of the Ring prequel, sequel, reimagining, whatever it is. Moving on to number 13, For Men Only, which, not to be confused with a British men's magazine. I wasn't even aware of this film, but the title struck me as that. This one's from 1952. Originally, or it was reissued as The Tall Lie. And I think that originally the director had a better title for it. It's supposed to be called Hell Knight.
But that's cool. That's a good title.
It is cool.
Yeah.
You know, it could be a horror film. Could be. But it also actually very pertinent to what the subject of the film is. But for some reason, the distributors came up with Four Men Only, which I'm still not sure what it refers to.
No, because it's about youngsters. It's not like men, is it?
boys becoming men through the timeless tradition and ritual of hazing to become part of college fraternities.
This is very much in the headlines today, but in terms of sports, I think both internationally and in my home country, Sweden, that there have been some very, very degrading and actually sexual, with sexual overtones, hazing within the like hockey and football clubs.
I did not know that, but yeah, I'm sure, you know, boys will be Neanderthals.
Yeah. So this was a very early example.
It was, and some people are surprised, but the actor-director, felt very strongly about the subject, which obviously cropped up in newspapers, and decided to make it his directing debut. So this is Paul Henreid, and he'd produced two films before that, but he had to work on the script and the financing for over a year to make it happen, and then it was shot in 16 days, and it's very earnestly meant. It's a good drama. I think what's outstanding about it is the, and this maybe comes down to him being an actor-director, being in it, is he's got incredible acting talent, many for whom this is the start of their career. So very impressive. Actors I'm less familiar with, Russell Johnson, better known to Americans as the professor on Gilligan's Island.
Yeah, okay.
But other ones which we do know about. So, for example, Margaret Field, mother of?
Sally Field,
very good. Vera Miles, best known from?
Psycho.
Good, testing you here. Actors like Kathleen Hughes and Robert Sherman, and, you know, interestingly enough, obviously Russell Johnson, not used to seeing him as the villain, but definitely where a lot of actors got their break.
Yeah, and of course Paul Henreid himself is very, very famous for his role in Casablanca.
Yes, I forgot that. You're right.
He is the love interest of Ingrid Bergman there.
So we don't have to go too much into the plot. Obviously, it is about college hazing. Why don't we play a clip from it, and then I'll get to my favorite review of the film.
Mrs. Palmer, did Todd ever tell you anything about Hell Night?
Only that it was the last night of his initiation into the fraternity.
Well, it is. It's the climax of the whole six-week affair. The final test for a pledge, and one which fraternities traditionally make the stiffest. Now, if Todd were injured, this affidavit releases Omega Nu from any responsibility.
And they want me to sign this?
Your boy's a minor. This is mainly a device fraternities use to frighten their pledges beforehand. A large part of the initiation is psychological.
Well, I don't know about these things, Dr. Bryce. None of us ever went to college except Todd. But it's in the newspapers all the time, someone getting hurt at these college initiations.
Well, an accident happens occasionally, yes, but...
Then how can I sign this? I'm his mother.
Mrs. Palmer, I'm opposed to hazing on every count. But Todd has had his heart set on belonging to this fraternity from the very first day he came to Wake. It's meant a great deal to him. He's taken all the punishment they could dish out, and I know it hasn't been easy. It would be a shame to stop him so short of his goal.
You mean that they wouldn't let him into the fraternity if I didn't sign it?
There is no telling. But if he were blackballed, they may label him a coward, and that, I'm afraid, would hurt Todd more than any initiation.
So that was a pivotal scene from Four Men Only. And having given you an idea of kind of what the film is about, because as you can probably guess, things aren't going to go too well, you know, for anyone being initiated into this, whatever disclaimer they sound. So I was reading up on IMDb, and I came across this review, and it just stood out. It popped out, and I have to share it in full here. So... I won't mention the reviewer, no naming and shaming, just to say that he said, I would give a zero if I could. This disgusting piece of trash actually depicts fraternity pledges being ordered to kill a puppy with a revolver. The entire crew and cast should be castrated for participating in this production. If you watch this movie past this ridiculous scene, you are probably the type of thug that would assault little elderly ladies trying to get home from a Trump White House event. I mean, that ending, it's like, okay, you're a thug who would assault little old ladies, so that, you're a bad person. But little old ladies, little elderly ladies, trying to get home from a Trump White House event.
As they do.
I have this mental image of little ladies shuffling out from the White House, sort of having said, thank you, Mr. President. And then getting assaulted by this woke, liberal, puppy-hating, fraternity-shaming, you know, Antifas.
And this is... They're so ridiculous. It's funny.
It is. Written in 2020. But the fact that somebody can get so riled up about a film that was made in 1952. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about next year it's going to be 70 years old.
It's crazy. But also it sounds like the reviewer thinks it's condoning killing puppies with revolvers.
Yeah, or that fraternities do these kind of things, or that we shouldn't...
Talk about it. I don't know.
Yeah. It's just bizarre on so many levels, but that's the beauty of the internet.
Yeah.
It's a forum for everybody. Right. Enough about four men only, and instead to a bit of a Swedish contribution in the Christmas Advent calendar.
Number
14, 47 löken.
Yes.
Tell us about it, Smutty.
47 onion.
47 onion.
In English.
Doesn't ring as good in English.
No. So this is a military farce from 1971, and I can say that military farces was a big thing in Sweden already from the 30s, I mean, especially and also during World War II, and leading up into the 50s, but here it got too much for the critics. Why would you make a military farce in 1971? It didn't make sense, and it got slagged. Like so many other films by the director Ragnar Frisk.
Yeah, prolific and, Ragnar Frisk.
Yes, and funnily enough, it was his birthday 2 days ago.
Yes, and happy birthday, Ragnar.
Yeah, happy birthday. And he was born in 1902, so he would have turned 119. So we will do a bigger celebration in 2022 when his 120th.
Hear, hear.
But he was a very productive director. He was... always shunned by the critics, but he was apt at directing. He could do it fast and efficiently, and which I think is so amazing, he was trained at UFA in Berlin in the 20s and studied for, among others, Fritz Lang.
Yes.
And he was his assistant director.
Mm.
So and that's
we have
pretty
several
cool.
of his films on Cultpix amongst his prolific output.
Yeah, we do. So we have the funny Under Your Parasol with the Swedish band Sven Ingvars. And maybe the one of the most notorious Swedish films ever, Raggargänget, or Swedish Punks, which is about these rockers who drive around in American cars and are nasty to little old ladies going from Trump rallies. No.
But it's the Swedish The Wild Ones, isn't it? With Marlon Brando.
And the funny thing is that the two guys in the lead roles were in their mid-30s and were supposed to be teenagers, and all of the other actors are actual teenagers. So it's a kind of a super-duper silly film.
But so the Swedish tradition for military comedies or farces, is that because Sweden never went to war for 200 years? Or so we have no other use for the army other than to mock them in films? Or how do we explain that?
Probably. I don't know. There were so many of them. It was a real genre. And every one of them were successes, especially the older ones.
Yeah.
And in this one, in 47 löken, they tried with there was a debut of a talented dancer, Lasse Kühler, who was famous just as a dancer. I think he has a dance school still. Mm. But his sidekick is played by Janne Loffe Karlsson, who actually got famous for another role as a soldier in a comedy TV series or drama comedy TV series.
Yes.
And as they did in these films, the music also has to be sort of funny and sort of military. So instead of the dialogue, we'll just play a little clip from the start of the film.
Hello.
from Swedish military forces to American non-militant lesbians.
See what I like that. I want to see that.
In fact, it is the 15th of our Advent calendar films. The American drama Just the Two of Us, 1970. Not to be confused with the Bill Withers song, is it?
Maybe, yeah.
I think so, yeah. Also known as The Dark Side of Tomorrow, which I like more as a title, although it sounds like a science fiction film.
I just thought you said Tamara.
Tamara, The Dark Side of Tomorrow. That's a good title for a lesbian drama.
Sorry. Couldn't help myself.
Just the two of us. We can make it if we try. Is a lesbian exploitation drama, which one of my favorite subgenres. It's about two very bored suburban housewives whose husbands are away on travel, as husbands were back in those days. And they start an affair with each other, being very bored, because that's how you become a lesbian. And then things get a bit nasty when one of them, who treats this as a bit of a joke, and the other one is more serious about it, and one of them starts an affair with a young man from the neighborhood. And this isn't appreciated by her friend. So what's fun about this film is that the financier, who was an Israeli investor, he wanted a X-rated sex film, but it was co-directed by a woman, Barbara Peters, and so she changed the storyline to be more about the lesbian relationship. And she actually said about the film that if you're going to involve yourself in a subject that's heretofore have been taboo, the first moves in that direction should be as close to reality as possible. So no, just don't jump straight into muff diving, scissoring, you know, whatever it is that your sick and twisted male fantasy about female and female relationships are. Let's make it about actual emotions.
So it was quite sympathetic towards lesbianism.
Well, and this is what's good about it, because let's face it, for how many years is it that, you know, the gay character in the film is the first one to be killed off?
Yeah.
Or just ends up unhappily. Unhappy gay character ending. That's a bigger cliche than anything else. And this wasn't it. You're right. It was very sympathetic to the whole notion of lesbianism. It was in the 70s, the women's liberation movement and so on. And it just started to filter through. So it was very much a kind of post-Stonewall period in terms of gay rights. So the mainstream media at this point was still fairly violently homophobic. So to come out with a film like this that treats the subject of female love with sensitivity and in a non-judgmental way is pretty much unique and it's ahead of its time.
Yeah.
So worth seeing for that rather than for gratuitous kind of things that you would find on Pornhub much more easily.
And of course, it's also a time capsule in terms of fashion and furniture and all of these things that we'd so appreciate in older films.
Yes, because they didn't have the budget for sets or costumes, so I'm sure they made the actors, you know, just bring whatever it is you wear normally.
Yeah, and we go home to Barbara's apartment and shoot it there.
Yeah, and it's got that furniture, which was there authentically, and then the kind of ugly green shag carpets, which are funny to us now, but they are a time capsule.
Yeah, for sure.
So let's play the trailer to get a bit of a feel for what it was like in the 70s.
There's no reason why you can't stay, is there?
No. No, I guess not. The other day, those two girls, I wanted it to be me and you. I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. I'm not.
You can't tell the texts, obviously, from only hearing it, but I had to search long and hard to find the trailer for it. And strangely enough, the only trailer I could find was a German trailer, even though it's not dubbed into German, because obviously films are. But it had the texts on in German. And the film in German, rather than being called The Dark Side of Tomorrow, or Tomorrow, or Just the Two of Us, Uns Zwei, Die dunkle Seite von Morgan. No, they called it Sündiger Sommer.
Sinful Summer.
Yes, which I feel is kind of judgmental. You know, were they to call it sinful? Mm. Just because it's lesbian.
Could have been called They Danced One Summer.
Yes, and did a lot more. Mm. But it started with the dancing.
So let's conclude.
Do let's. What have we got in the final for this week?
It's number 16. Behind the lid is hiding Tormented, a film from 1960. And this, I don't think you know this, this is one of the first films that were screened by Something Weird Video, Mike Rainey and Lisa Petrucci, when they were in Sweden 20 years ago for the Something Weird Film Festival. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Which means
brilliant
that choice. In our warehouse, we have a big pile of postcards for Tormented that were made just for this occasion.
Oh, brilliant. And do they feature the talking head?
No, it's the poster image of it. But I love the... Yeah, you found that talking head as a gift, didn't you?
Yes, it is. It is made to be gift. So if
very
you haven't,
much so.
If you haven't seen on social media, it is a very blonde woman's head being held up and she kind of spits out her dialogue. She's clearly not happy about being headless or the state of how she got to be headless.
Yeah, but you will hear a little bit of it in the trailer, actually.
Yes, you will. Although you can't tell that it's her
it's headless. It's bodiless.
So it's a fun little dark thriller. And I had no idea about that. Something weird. So extra bonus there.
Yeah.
Plot summary, very quickly. Tom, jazz pianist, is about to get married to what seems to be a very lovely woman on a California island wedding, only to have it potentially spoiled by the arrival of his ex. Doesn't seem very nice. V, who shows up secretly. And no spoiler alert here, but when they can have a confrontation at the island's lighthouse, the railing breaks, V falls, and Tom doesn't do very much to save her, obviously being more focused on his impending nuptials. So poor V falls down into the ocean, washes up, very dead. What happens then? You were at the screening.
I don't remember the story. I remember just that she comes back and fucks up their life.
Yeah, and definitely spoils the wedding.
Yeah.
So it's a ghost at the wedding, you know, doesn't anybody object kind of thing. Last thing you want is a ghost of a dead ex-girlfriend or, you know, her ghostly head voicing her objections and saying that, you know, the groom killed her. So that is, it's a good cost for such a low-budget thriller. I don't know why Julie Redding, who plays V. Mason, the talking head, and looks very much like a kind of angry Marilyn Monroe, didn't have a much more of a career after this. But, you know, she's terrific in this small part.
Yeah.
And, of course, the director was Mr. Big, otherwise known as Burt I. Gordon.
Yes, one of my favorite directors, because everything he touched was either giant animals or insects or tiny, tiny people.
Yeah.
In so many of his films. I don't know why he was so hung up on that.
Why don't we play the trailer before we talk a little bit more about the cast and other fun things about it.
No one will ever love you more than I do.
Can a man step away from his past into a future free from fear? Or must a dead past return, making of every living moment a time tortured, tormented? Tormented, holding you spellbound for the she-ghost of Haunted Island. Dreams of desire overshadowed by nightmares. Can a dead love's lust destroy a man? Or can a man defy the she-ghost of Haunted Island?
It's going to be just as though you never existed. I'm going to marry Meg.
But at the wedding rehearsal was one uninvited guest.
I'll never let you marry Meg. You belong to me, Tom.
You belong to a ghost.
Tom Stewart killed me! Tom Stewart killed me!
That was the trailer for Tormented. And before we finish, I got to say one more thing about it. In terms of the cast, one of the other great things I love about the fact is we get a part by Joe Turkel. And you will know him by his uncanny, very distinct appearance, because, of course, you recognize him as famously being the bartender from The Shining. And, of course, he had other parts for Kubrick before that, which I'd forgotten about, such as The Killing and Paths of Glory. But, of course, famously, he was also Dr. Eldon Tyrell, the android manufacturer in Blade Runner. And reason enough to see it, Joe Turkel. That brings to the end the 16th and, for this time, final film from the Cultmas Badvent calendar. Hope you enjoy some, none, or all of these films on Cult Picks, and we will be back wrapping up with the last films and some final Christmas festive cheers from your Cult Picks. So for now, that's all for me.
And me, the Smut Peddler.
Here at Cult Picks Radio WCPX 66.6. Ho, ho, ho.
Was the night before Christmas when all through the castle my monsters were having a yuletide hassle. The tree was all trimmed in ghoulish things like werewolf fangs and vampire wings.
It was a monster's holiday,
but they were up to no good.
It was a monster's holiday,
didn't act like good monsters should.
It was a monster's holiday,
they found themselves a new prey.
It was a monster's holiday,
they planned to rob Santa's sleigh. They were making a list and checking it twice. Frankenstein wanted a shiny new trike, a new chain for Janusz, a brace for Igor's back, a speed shaver for Wolfman, a new cape for Drac. They were up to no good, didn't act like good monsters should. They'd found themselves a new prey. They planned to rob Santa's sleigh. The mummy was to signal from the castle roof at the very first sound of a reindeer hoof. As Santa slid down the chimney wall, the zombies were to make off with sleigh and all. From beyond the moat there arose such a clatter, I jumped to the window to see what was the matter. Like a bolt of lightning it happened so quick, and there in our midst stood old Saint Nick. He began to dig down deep in his sack and came up with the traction for Igor's back. Drac caught his cape, Frankie's trike made him behave. Even Wolfman was happy, now he can shave.
Monster's holiday,
and all ended well.
Monster's holiday,
and Santa was really swell.
Monster's holiday,
no need to rob Santa's sack. Maybe next year he'll come back, so the children everywhere were spared the grief.